probably not working.
This is not a lead-up point.
It was le jour des collisions, the day of the collisions. On an otherwise ordinary Saturday during a year that has since been expunged by historical revisionists, the entire earth was rocked by things crashing into one another. Animal, vegetable, mineral. Anything that could potentially be guessed in 20 questions was fair game for a brief dynamic event in which something that closely approached something else triggered an abrupt change of momentum. It started with minerals. Far below Kansas, in an area undergroundologists called the Mohorovicic discontinuity, argumentative geophysical forces were hard at work crafting a vast network of intersecting fault lines. All six major slices of planetary crust on which plate tectonics theory was based had shifted just enough to put them on one massive subterranean collision course. On that day, el día de las colisiones, earthquakes ruled the world and the ground sundered. No place was spared. And for reasons no sane theorist could explain, the collisions extended far beyond the lithosphere. You just jump right in here whenever you...
I'm musically jumping.
Ah, right. An Arctic Ocean baleen whale, fit to krill, slammed into a basket of hot naan from a Calcutta cafe.
Krill? Weren't they on one of the episodes of Star Trek or Voyager or one of those? Wasn't the krill one of the races that objected to one of the other races?
Were those the krill?
I thought they were the krill. They might have not been spelled that way.
A buffalo mime, attempting to walk against the wind, was hit by a massive cold front that had its roots in Gondwanaland. The last remaining calf of the iceberg that brought the Titanic to its knees 90-some Aprils ago struck the head of Lincoln at Mount Rushmore. However, it was the adjacent noggin of Roosevelt that sank. Two dendrochronologically challenged bristlecone pines, normally rooted fast to cryptogamic soil in a remote Utah arroyo, simultaneously sideswiped a solar panel truck double-parked in front of Wrigley Field. A corollary from Heisenberg's uncertainty principle ran into a healthy dose of skepticism from a team of dark matter phenomenologists at the University of Hamilton-Smythe in southwesternmost Lincolnshire.
I really wish they were phrenologists.
They couldn't be, then I would mispronounce that too. In turn, the phenomenologists rear-ended a wayward piece of the Calcutta Naan. But most noteworthy to the loyal band of audience who call 91.1 FM home, even if they rarely call us to confirm it, was the near chaos that resulted from an innumerable number of musical collisions. Like that. No matter the ground beneath them was doing the seismological equivalent of a fandango, musicians the world over continued to do what they did best, which was to avoid working at real jobs.
Hey, that's not fair!
Sure, they worked, but to the beat of a drummer wholly different from most typical wage earners. Unlike most other earthbound entities, music mongers as a whole remained free from inter-instrumental collisions. Oh, sure, the occasional brass player crashed headlong into the percussion section, but...
Best place.
Yeah, but such an event was routine during the course of any musical season. However, never before had the music itself found itself on so many collision courses. Notes that previously had hung elegantly in the air over an orchestral's final chord now sought out Tarkin's with abandon. Half notes hammered hemi-demi-semi-quavers. Breves...
You wanted to say hemi-demi-semi-claviers.
Claviers. Hemi-demi-semi-claviers. Ooh.
That was kind of a very short Bach piece.
Yeah.
well-tempered hemi-demi.
Yes. Breves, bashed barcaroles. Concertos, clobbered cantatas. Symphonies smashed into song cycles. Obligatos overwhelmed ottava. Wozzeck whacked die Walküre.
Yeah!
Such a panoply of aural chaos might even... nonplussed John Cage. At the Central Kakaithi's School of Double Reeds in Chicago, all 91 bassoonists suddenly felt compelled to simultaneously chuff away on low B flats. The resultant... What's wrong with your machine? Oh, he's playing with the knobs over there.
He's playing with knobs?
Or buttons. The resultant bassoonami created disharmonious wavelengths that devastated the city and partly inverted nearby Lake Michigan. Fortunately, the tectonic upheaval lasted but a day.
Oh, doggone.
No matter the Earth's surface was a shambles when the sun rose the following morning, seismologically, things were back to normal. Unable to account for the quick recovery, scientists turned to the historical revisionists to reinvent the day.
Well, let's rethink this.
But the two main factions of the Guild of Revampers were equally divided. The amelioraticians maintained it was merely a planet-wide hiccup that was essentially good for the Earth. The deterioratists said it was the result of an altercation with a giant space badger, which would be back with its querulous sister. Each camp was so unyielding in its conviction that at last both positions were discarded and the day was simply removed from history. The Earth recovered, though like a boxer who had stood in the ring too long, it now had a ringing in its eras. Chicago was rebuilt, its destruction re-remembered as having been caused by Patrick O'Leary's cow. Bassoonists, as soon as they were old enough to play in tune, typically concurrent with their midlife crises, were taught to shun low B flats when congregating in large groups. Trombone and tuba players still ran into kettle drummers and triangulationists, but extended their abrupt change of momentum to the woodwind section. Dark matter phenomenologists traded colluding for colliding and dramatically increased their net worth. A few people still linked some vague, catastrophic event to the number 11. Was that a date? An o'clock? A reference to a ruinous football team? No one knew. Gradually, the initial syllable was forgotten, which left 11. Or, more to the point, on today's 515th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, Levin, as in Johann, an in-studio compositional guest whose tales of calamity, catastrophe, and collision surpass even the unrelentingly lambasted lives of Damien and Calvos.
That is absolutely true.
True.
We have got it today.
Yes,
we have collisions abounding today.
No doubt.
11, by the way, is that wonderful measure in The Rite of Spring, that 11-4. That's 11. That's a measure of 11.
That's
the only measure of 11 in The Rite of Spring.
The only one?
Yes.
You've checked?
I have.
Wow.
Ah, I love that. Speaking of colliding things.
Kaleidoscopes.
We are listening to a collision of music by William Duckworth, a former guest on Calvos and Damien, and the Ill Wind Ensemble, formerly made up of one of the members who's in the studio today, and they're colliding on this particular mix with the Duckworth pieces, which are made in a piece of software called Super Collider.
Oh, wonderful.
So we'll just listen to that for the next couple of minutes, and we'll be back.
Thank you.
a mix of music by Roddy Schrock. Not Roddy Schrock. It was Roddy Schrock is the other person who appeared that day. That's William Duckworth.
Right.
And also the Ill Wind Ensemble. The pieces by Duckworth are not named on this particular recording we have. But the Ill Wind Ensemble piece we listened to was Envoys of the Sun King.
Sun King,
and nothing to do with collisions there, except that we collided it with the Super Collider music by William Duckworth.
Wasn't Sun King a Chinese over-the-counter restaurant supplier?
That was Sun Ra.
Ah, Sun Ra, yes, okay.
So, John Levin's here. Welcome to Calvos and Damien.
Well, thanks.
As always.
Yes, not the first time. Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
We're going to play something we're going to talk over. Is that what you told us?
Yeah.
Let's do that. What do we have that we're going to talk over? I love talking over things.
We're talking over one of many CDs, homemade CDs, which are simply labeled... Where'd it go? Isn't it? I gave it to you.
Tweak. Wasn't that Tweak?
Yeah. They're simply labeled Tweak, Live at the Weather Vane.
And this dates from when?
This dates from probably about 6 weeks ago.
Oh, so you're not an ex-composer. You're still going.
This is newly minted.
Hot dog.
Ah, there it is in the background. Well, we'll bring it up in a little while.
Okay.
I have to ask you how you're doing after your
we last
saw John at a performance of the Vermont Symphony where they were playing a piece of mine, and not long afterwards you had a conflagration,
a major catastrophe. The residents of 32 Main Street in Brattleboro were awakened by the fire alarm going off at 6:10 on the morning of Saturday, December 4th, 2004, and people were out in the hallway saying, get out, it's real. And I threw on a pair of sweatpants and a shirt and a sweater, grabbed my car keys and a pair of flip-flops, and headed downstairs. And there were pieces of molten glass drifting down from the second and third floor. And we all got out of the building, got out on the street, and looked at it, and saw flames coming out of the windows, and we all realized in our hearts it was the last time we were going to see most of what we had to see in the building.
Except, as they say, the shirts on your backs. It was really one of those cases.
It turned out later on that the wreckage coughed up more than one initially would have been led to imagine, watching it go from the parking lot. I got back in a month after, and during the lunch break of Renault Brothers Construction, who were doing the demolition, I had about 25 minutes to get back into the front room where all of my tapes, CDs, scores, instruments, and everything else was. And in that 25 minutes, I had to make the horrible decision of which of the children do you save?
Oh, you mean they simply weren't going to let you in at all, and so you just had to slip in and grab stuff.
Yeah, it was semi-illegal. They were freaking out because it was semi-illegal for us to be in there because, you know, we weren't bonded and insured by Renault's bonded and insurance, and if the floor had caved in or the roof had caved in or something bad had happened to us, we could have sued them. So it was sketchy for us to be in there.
That's that became known in the legal trade as the Renault syndrome.
Well, I sure had it on that day, I got out some scores, which for me is interesting because I don't do a lot of notes on paper music. But I got some scores out, and I got out.
And these were all recognizable. They had not been destroyed by the conflagration.
Yeah, they had not been destroyed, and also like all of my master tapes, my like half inch and one inch master tapes from my Mills College days. We're in this wooden built-in thingy, and they survived. I mean, I don't know how well they survived because they were baked to a temperature of probably about 1,000 degrees and then cooled off. So who knows what happened?
We do that with tapes just to make them work again.
So, but also, I mean, like a little wooden, Renaissance wooden alto recorder survived. And it survived in open air. It survived a fire, and then it survived in the open air sleet, snow, freezing rain, temperatures in the teens, temperatures in the 30s, and it was intact.
They knew how
to bake them back there.
Bake them.
But other things, it's really funny because there was this one corner where the two ARPs were, the ARP Odyssey and the ARP 2600, and where all my old LPs were. And that corner was this corner that the firefighters were fighting the fire, and they couldn't put this corner out. This corner wouldn't go out, and it wouldn't go out. And when I finally got to see that corner, it was nothing but a toppled pile of bricks and soot. So it was kind of like the big locus of, you know, of what I thought was the big core of my existence was just absolutely obliterated.
So do the fire people think that's what started the fire? The ARPs?
The ARPs self-immolated?
No, it wasn't like a bum power supply and a 32-year-old analog synth that caused the building to go down.
No, I think it was sentient.
Attitude, yes.
I don't know.
Telling you, they've been in Vermont too long, they wanted to go back to Mills, and there was no other way to tell you that. I bet if you go to Mills, you'll find them there.
Or General Mills.
Yeah.
Well, it's also strange. The week after the fire, a friend of mine at work was so distraught by this event that he spent the entire week of work, he just blew off work, and he surfed the web reading about ARPs, and he surfed eBay, and he found within a week the exact same 2600 that I had, and he bought it for me.
Ooh, yes. All right.
Well, can you tell him that we're in desperation?
I just turned my microphone off. We'll get back to your tale. Let's listen to some of this music, and we'll be back.
You want to explain any bit first?
Sure. Tweak is a duo. It's myself and Charlie Schneeweiss.
Oh, a former... Yeah.
And Charlie's been teaching electronic music at Marlboro College down in Marlboro, Vermont, for a couple of years. And last fall, he said, you know, I'm doing all this stuff with electronics, and you have all this old electronic stuff that you don't go near anymore, and it's time for you to get it out, and it's time for us to do something with it.
Wow.
So...
Should have called us. We'll talk later.
Yeah.
This is John Levin, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
WGDR Plainfield.
The award-winning.
Excellence in broadcasting.
That's us.
Excellent from the gorgeous WGDR and... and our ASCAP Themes Taylor Awards, our Internet Journalism in the year 2000, and we are still exploiting it 5 years later.
If only we could exploit the catering.
There wasn't catering. We brought our own cheese.
No, not to the ASCAP.
Oh, yes. We did bring our own cheese, though.
Oh, right. Of course. Yes indeed. Yes.
And back to John Levin and Charlie Schneeweis and Schneeweis, right? He says it with a schnee.
Yeah, I say schnee. I say schnee. It's, everyone says schnee, and Charlie says schnee, so it must
it's like
be.
Like the knights who say schnee, 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 I hear electronic ducks.
That sounded like a duck, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Duck and Cover.
I don't know what that was.
No relation to Duckworth, the piece we started out with.
No. So talk about this. What are we hearing?
Okay, this is definitely me playing a Moog, made by Moog.
Wait, would there be any question about whether it's you?
No, it wouldn't be any question about whether it's me.
I see, all right. Well, I mean, if you played it, you should sort of like recognize it.
I should,
unless you were in an altered state.
I was drinking a Duval at the moment, but...
Robert? Brought in from Belgium?
Yeah.
Real Duval?
See, there's this new place in Brattleboro, which is called the Weather Vane. And Charlie and I perform there every other Tuesday. And so every other Tuesday, we take two old Moog Concertmate Realistic MG1s.
And you should point out that this is made by Radio Shack or made by the...
Made by Moog. Made by Moog under contract to Radio Shack.
Okay.
So while it says Realistic on the backside, in tiny letters on the front side, it says Moog Music. And this has sort of become the vintage retro analog synth for the low budget eBayer because they are only about $350 instead of, say, $700.
It's very funny because when you mentioned this off mic, I said, oh, I recognize that immediately because there was a guy locally who ran the Radio Shack who had one, and I had to fix it. And it was just a nightmare to fix because it was just crumbly stuff inside. And you mentioned the same stuff, the terrible foam that was crumbling off, and the contacts were bad, and it was really difficult to fix. Got to fix, though.
Yeah. So every other Tuesday... we trot out these two Moog MG1s, and I use a Line 6 DL4 digital delay. Charlie plays also an Alesis Air Synth. Have you ever seen this thing?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's a little box about 6.5 by 6.5, and it has a little plastic dome in the center of it, and it uses sort of garage door technology, electric eye, you know. And it's like a theremin. I mean, you wave your hands over the little plastic dome, and it changes the pitch and amplitude of these 32 little preset sounds.
Wow.
And Charlie also plays he plays laptop and a Roland SH-32.
What does he use on his laptop?
I don't even know.
Uh-huh.
I've never asked him.
Okay.
I've never looked. And a Roland SH-32, which is a digital synth, but it's got, again, it's like, it's got all these knobs and sliders and dials on it. So, because we do all this knob, slider, dial music, we decided to call ourselves Tweak.
Yeah.
And so anyway, every other Tuesday in Brattleboro, we do this, and about anywhere from 8 to 20 people show up, and they sit around drinking coffees and Belgian beers and red wine and talk in the background.
So what is it with vintage synths? This is all of a sudden a real interest that has arisen. I've noticed it because there are vintage synths being recreated in hardware as well as software, and there's a whole virtual school of vintage synth users, if only the sounds, if not the instruments themselves.
Yeah. I think it all started with techno. I think that had a lot to do with it. There was a particular, what was it, the Roland... TB-303 or something, which was this little bass synthesizer that was used on a ton of house and techno tracks in the late 80s, early 90s. And that kind of got the ball rolling. But, I mean, beyond that, I mean, I know why I have stuck with it all these years, and it's because I don't like punching in parameters on little LED screens, and I work at a computer all day long, so I don't like working with a computer at the end of the day. And I like knobs and sliders.
You like the physical nature of moving the controls and actually having them respond to what you do.
Yeah. And also over the years, I had sort of developed this weird personal vocabulary, which is all about oscillators going out of tune.
There's one right now.
Oh, we love it.
Yeah. Serendipitous nature of live radio. Well, how many people are doing this? I mean, have you seen a kind of a movement toward this? Aside from the techno world?
Yeah.
How is that happening?
I've seen it. I mean, I've seen a lot of bands that have, I've seen a lot of improvisers who have billed themselves as, you know, free improv people working with analog electronics. So it's kind of infiltrated its way a bit into sort of the musique actuelle, free improv universe. I've seen it, well, I mean, also, you know, Moog decided to reissue the Voyager, which is like, it's like a reissued mini Moog, which is all analog. And then there's this guy.
And, and it is all analog. It's not digitally emulated inside. It's actually analog circuitry.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. I mean, there are digital aspects of the signal path because it can store patches. But the filters are analog. The oscillators are analog. Everything is analog. So, I mean, there's manufacturers who are making analog. And at the same time, there are musicians who are... who are trying to make analog.
Well, we could... Is it time to... No, we won't say anything about that just now.
Not yet.
Not yet.
I got really inspired... Yeah, I think it was around 2002. We went down to this place in East Hampton, Massachusetts, called The Flywheel, and we saw Cor Fuller, who's from Amsterdam. He's sort of part of the whole Amsterdam scene. He's a composer, pianist. And Cor Fuller did a whole set on a modified... what's it called? The suitcase synthesizer that they made in England. The
EMS?
The EMS.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Portabella. And he did an entire set on the Portabella. Just, and it was just amazing, you know, to see someone do a whole set of improv using this little ancient suitcase synth. It was great. So I said, well, if Cor Fuller can do that,
yeah,
why can't I?
Well, it's interesting because... a generation or two has gone by since these instruments were first issued, and I think there's a lot of experience in how to use electronic sound effectively, part of which was fueled by the digital era. And we learned a lot of ways of working and sounds we could make, which we can then take back to kind of this hands-on method of using with the analog synths now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really a revelation in the quality of improv now. I mean, we used to do improvs with our instruments and with some friends' instruments in the 1970s. And I have not dared to listen to the recordings. Several of them are recorded. But I would bet that we simply had no clue as to the depth of possibility at the time.
Or there was also a lack of talent.
Oh, well, that's a given. But even with that, we could do better today.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the 70s, because the 70s, I mean, it's been happening for a while, but the 70s are really being mined. I mean, in pop music in particular, there are lots of rock bands that are mining the 70s. And I think that has, the mining of the 70s, I think, has a lot to do with the analog revival as well.
Also, the people who used to be the rock bands of the 70s are coming back because they can't find anything else that they can do.
And Botox is really good these days.
Sure is.
Let's listen to some of this. And is there another cut following that we just let go and listen to it for a while?
We could.
Or do you have something else we should hear?
Well, there's lots more.
We should change the tone a little bit.
Let's do it.
Yeah, well, we could change the tone rather radically if you wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
We could, just throw this in for a moment. We can start at the beginning and then we can move inwards.
Does that say ink?
It says in C.
Oh, in C. Ah, brings back memories of, I don't know, maybe it's just a figment of my imagination.
Not the in C.
Well, yeah, in fact.
Well, let's hear about this particular performance then.
Okay. I a while ago, I was, you know, reading some music history book, and I noted that In C was first performed in November of 1964. And when I'd been living out on the West Coast, they did like a 25th anniversary performance of it, and then they did a 30th anniversary performance of it. And I got it into my head. I thought, well, when 40 rolls around, I'm going to organize a 40th anniversary performance of In C in Brattleboro.
Right, you invited us, but we didn't come.
We avoided it. We stayed in C minor.
Well, I invited my entire email list, and I got an ensemble together of about 16 musicians, which is less than the number that Terry says you should have in the score, but it was enough. So we forged ahead, and it was a really remarkable combination of people. There were professional musicians, there were amateur musicians, there were rock musicians, jazz musicians, classical musicians.
What sort of instrumentation did you get?
We got, there were a lot of, there were...
Mini Moogs.
Yeah. There was one synthesizer, but I don't remember what it was. Two recorders, one flute, one clarinet, one violin, two trumpets, French horn, cello, metallophone, percussion, piano, synthesizer, and probably something I'm forgetting.
So the cello was the bass of the crew?
Oh, an electric bass.
Oh, an electric. Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And, you know, the performance, I mean, we'll play some of it. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of rehearsals, and everyone was at different levels of ability. So, you know, it's got some rough edges. It has some rough edges, but it has a certain kind of charm that I really like. And the other thing about it, too, is that, I mean, the whole process of putting this performance together was very interesting because, you know, I hadn't realized this when you start out, but rehearsals of NC, if you do it collaboratively, they turn into like a little town meeting in a way. You know, you play the piece through, and then you sit back and you talk about how it went, and you say, well, this would work better. And personalities emerge, and there are controlling personalities, and there are mellow personalities, and there are intermediate personalities. And it really, it becomes this like, it's like a
it's an organism.
Yeah, yeah, it becomes an organism.
And a handgun-free zone. Let's listen to this. This was done when?
This was November 4th, just this past November 4th.
Our guest, by the way, today is John Levin.
Thank you.
listening to In C by Terry Riley in a performance from last November, 2004. John Levin's our guest, and you organized, what, you said about 20 people for this?
It was about 20 people. And for Brattleboro, this was a good sign. About 60 people showed up for the concert.
Ooh.
Where did you have it?
At the Vermont Jazz Center, which is in Cotton Mill Hill, which is an old, used to be the Dunham Shoe Factory. And there's a couple of performance spaces in that building, and they had just enlarged the space. So it was kind of, imagine this, like, big warehouse space. And I was earlier talking about sort of the town meeting hall style of putting together a performance of NC. There was a lot of collective discussion about how to do the piece. And one of the musicians said, you know, we should, rather than sitting up on the stage, which is, you know, let's surround the audience. So we did it.
Get out of that proscenium.
Yeah, yeah. So we did it with the musicians in a circle facing inwards, looking at each other across the audience, who kind of sat in the middle.
And where was the timekeeper?
The piano, the pulse was on stage.
Well, also the wood blocker.
The wood blocker was in behind the piano, sort of that, if the piano was at noon, the wood blocker was sort of at 6 o'clock on the other side.
Okay, and we're about coming into the home stretch.
Yeah, we moved it ahead a little bit here because you said there were some interesting events taking place
toward
the end.
Yeah, from the last 5 minutes, I've listened to this a lot, and I like those. And also, you know, it's like everyone listens to the beginning, but does everyone always make it through to the end? So
not awake, including performers. Vermont Contemporary Music Ensemble tried this, didn't they?
Yes, it was an... I think we made it through in 36 minutes, or maybe even less.
Yeah, you couldn't wait to get it over with.
Right. There was a different feeling about it.
And then I heard the world's worst performance of this. I don't know, were you there? The absolute most hideous performance of NC I have ever heard was done by Kronos Quartet and Electric Phoenix.
Oh, that was just dreadful.
It was dreadful.
It had no purpose.
They had the, you know, the voices of Electric Phoenix singing the part and the Kronos Quartet. And talk about something that did not work. There was not a moment from the beginning to the end that it functioned as a piece of music.
No, it was all glitz. It was
personality of the performers, but the music never sounded through it. And they were each, you know, the singers were kind of little bellowing their little lines and being cute. And Kronos was you know, swooping and diving like they do. And
in their matching outfits?
In their matching outfits. And it didn't seem like voices and string quartet were going to work for the piece. It just didn't feel like it was going to happen. And when we got there, it was almost as dreadful as some other performances we've seen at the Flynn Theater recently. So, well, let's listen to this untrammeled by our voices last 6.5 minutes of In C. Do you want to, did you name the group?
I can remember some of them. The documentation of this performance, of course, was...
Well, I wondered if you named the group. Did you call it something?
Oh, no. No, we just called it the 40th Anniversary Performance of In C.
Well, that makes an anagram. Let's see, how do you...
Fatboink.
There you go.
Fatboinks.
Yeah.
When it was over, there was this... I mean, the audience was very enthusiastic about it, and the players were really enthusiastic. It was a very positive experience for everyone. And when it was over, the players all said, you know, we should get together and, like, make a contemporary music ensemble to do more pieces like this, but nothing ever came.
Everybody ran, yeah.
Yeah.
Live performance of In C from November of 2004 and in Brattleboro at the Jazz Center, you said, was it?
Right, and you know, the other thing I'm remembering about this that made it really memorable was that it was 2 days after the election. And so everyone in that little corner of that little blue state was really, we were all like really zombies and in Z. And when it was over, I mean, so many people said, you know, that was just what I needed after the election. I had to go and see something that was sort of, you know, that kind of far out and heartfelt and different. And it really kind of, for 42 minutes, it really cheered people up.
It's not like watching commercials with Bob Dylan singing for Victoria's Secret or anything. Well, it was an interesting performance, that's for sure. There were changes. Instead of that sort of strict minimalism tempo, the tempo was flexible. Some players broke the strict rhythm and flowed against it, and the character of it was very personal.
I agree. I think that it really was a very kind of, I mean, all the personalities made it what it was.
So how do you, to change the topic again, how do you, as an artist, bounce back from your fire?
Well, the first week is the most interesting week in a way. That's the kind of heroic week, because that's the week in which you have to get through the anxiety and the sleeplessness and everything else and put your life sort of back together again. And then after that heroic week, what sort of then comes back is sort of the despairing period of time, which seems to last quite some time. But the other thing that happens, which I feel like was really true for me, is that in that moment when you're like stripped of all your possessions and your passport and everything that you think identifies you, and you're left with just sort of who you are as a person, in that time you sort of find this weird kind of confidence that you didn't know that you had. So that whereas before I was always kind of half apologetic about my work, in the sense that, you know, I'm a minimalist, I work with drones, I work with old technology, I work with tonality, and it's weird music that I'm afraid no one is ever going to understand. And I always approached it with this kind of like half apologetic, oh, here comes John the weird composer again, isn't that too bad kind of thing.
That's in fact how we were anticipating the show today.
And after the fire, it's like, I don't care anymore what anyone thinks. It's, I don't care. Because it's like you come out of the event as a sort of a whole person, and when that's done, you don't care what someone thinks. If what's important is your intention and your sincerity, and if that's there, what other people think doesn't really matter. And so if it doesn't really answer your question, but you know, as to how you keep moving forward or how you but in terms of the main impact that the event had on me was to make me realize that, you know, the important thing is to do it and to be sincere and believe in oneself and not worry about all the other stuff.
Do you think it changed since Ill Will? Has your output differed?
Ill Win, sorry, not Ill Will.
It was good, though.
There were a couple of... Charlie and I had been doing these tweak performances at the Weather Vane, these every other Tuesday performances before the fire, and then we started to do them after the fire, and there were...
How long was the wait before you started doing them again?
The fire was on the 4th, and the first gig was December, like, 29th.
So not that long.
Yeah. The first time back, actually, was with the Odyssey off of eBay that didn't work. It was like, I hadn't even played it before until I plugged in, but that's another story. But anyway, there were a couple of tweak performances after the fire that were just like really, they were dark. I mean, they were just more somber and they were more aggressive and they were more noisy and they were more chaotic. And so it did seem like there was this period where, you know, there was this like dark thing going on.
So, but Charlie was obviously part of this. Was he reflecting you, or were you just overburdening or overbalancing performances?
Hard to say. I may have been. Well, we had this expression in the Ill Wind Ensemble, and we use it in Tweak too, which is pulling focus, which is that moment when you're like, you know, when you're improvising and you're afraid that something interesting isn't happening, so you decide to do something interesting. We call that pulling focus. Mm-hmm. So it could have just been me pulling focus, but it could have also been his response to the event as well, because he was one of the first people I called. I woke him out of a pretty sound sleep on a Saturday morning at like 6:30 to tell him that this was happening. And he and his wife showed up within a half an hour, as did my friend Tom. You know, the two people that I called got them out of a sound sleep, and they were both there within a half an hour. So Charlie was one of, you know, a handful of people who stood with Sarah and I, my wife Sarah and I, as we stood in the Brattleboro Food Co-op parking lot and watched the place go up. So he shared that experience with me. So it was probably mutual.
Mm-hmm. You were right on online immediately afterwards. I think I heard from you that evening.
Yeah. My Sarah and I had very different approaches to dealing with the disaster, and her approach was to kind of go very inward, and I had a sort of more extroverted approach where I was like, you know, I got online and sent emails to people, because that was my way, in a way, of kind of saying that it happened.
You know, John McGuire, a composer from New York who's been a guest on our show a couple of times, had a fire about a year ago, and it was an equivalently massively destructive fire where he lost his life's work. And his nature is one that is so quiet and so laid back that it was never any evidence of there having been a fire in the way his life seemed from the outside. And his work, similar to yours, exists only in one copy, in a sense. You work with a lot of electronics and had all these master tapes. John does a lot of electronics, but he scores it all in ink. And so all the ink scores, including the one he'd been working on for several years, were lost in the fire. So it was really a very strange year, because composers don't tend to have these kinds of massive events happen like that, and to see the different way in which each of you reacted to these events was amazing.
And they were both guests on our show.
Yes.
There's a pattern.
There is. Yes. They were both returned guests on the show.
Even worse. Or not. Sorry. No, not worse.
Has anyone else, though, done it three times, like me?
The show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not for long.
Not lived.
Have you booked up all the Saturdays between now and September?
Yes, and so since you bring it up, I should mention that next week on our show, Troy Peters will be joining us. We'll be joining Damien, because Calvos is going to be kayaking in the Gulf.
Unless the waves conflagrate his kayak.
Yes, that's true. And then the week after that, Thomas L. Reed, Larry Reed, will be here. And things are falling.
Disaster.
And then the week after that, a live performance from Studio Z, Shushu Chang will be here playing amazing and inconsolable pieces. Yes, they will be. And many more coming up. We're booked straight through 17th of September to the Composer Combat edition of Calvos and Damien, our last show, in which it will be a two-day event in which composers will write music to be read and on the spot, and we'll beat each other up and have judges and have subterfuge and suicide and all of those good things that happen to composers all in one spot.
Yeah, right here.
A long answer to your question.
Wow.
Let's listen to something else. You've got some more Tweak queued up for us.
Yeah, this is another Tweak live at the Weather Vane, and I believe this track also features myself, Charlie Schneeweis, and a performer whose last name I don't know, but whose first name is Devin. Devin lives in Bellows Falls. And one of the things that started happening when we started doing these Tweak performances at the Weather Vane is that people started to sort of come out of the woodwork. So Devin is a circuit bender. You guys?
Oh, yeah. The circuit bending is amazing. Go on. Explain this. This is really quite funny.
Yeah, circuit bending is this... I don't know how long circuit bending's been around.
It's been around from the beginning. It's just that it acquired a name in recent times as a second generation of people started to do it.
And it's taking commercial electronic devices and opening them up, resoldering them, putting new circuits in them, and basically turning them to purposes for which they were not otherwise built, you could say. There's a guy in Brattleboro who has a circuit bent speak and spell, or see and say. And... I just found these guys on the internet, I forget their website, who make a circuit bent television. It has an audio input jack on the side, and you plug your audio signal in, and then the TV just makes these oscillating patterns. But there's this huge warning on the circuit bent TV site that says, kids, don't do this at home, because opening up a TV is, there's a lot of juice in that thing. So circuit bending, I mean, it goes back to, Michael Weisvich at Stein, he did a lot of that. And so anyway, this guy Devin one night, he shows up. He just shows up. He read about us on the web, and he just shows up. And he has a Casio MT40, just like one of the most basic Casios you've ever seen. And, you know, it's got like little like leopard skin decals on it, but it also has like extra knobs and sliders, plus little screws that are somehow tied in with galvanic skin response. And so Devin showed up with this circuit bent Casio MT40, and we just said, well, come on up here and plug it in and see what happens.
We used to have the early little tiny Casio sampling keyboard. What was that called?
The SK1.
Yes, that's right. And we got some of these for...
What do you mean, had? I still have one.
Well, I have mine in storage, yes. And we got one of these for the school that I was teaching music at the time. This was, 1985 or something like that. I forget exactly what year this was. And I stripped the keyboard out and replaced it with contacts so that we could do wind chimes or sword fights or pads or whatever. You could hook up anything that made two contacts with this device and then sample stuff, and then with the contacts play. No matter how you wanted to do it, with whatever you wanted to do. As I said, like the sword fights, you know, the two or three kids would be wired to the swords. Each side would be one contact on the keyboard, and you'd have this great cacophony of sampled sounds exploding from the speakers from playing with them. It's a lot of fun. It was great. Long before it was called circuit bending, but lots of fun. So, he showed up at your concert.
Yeah.
And this is the result?
This is the result.
Anything more?
No, that I think is enough.
Our guest today is John Levin, and not just his circuits are bent.
Thank you.
Circuit-bending analog retro WGDR mavens. My name is John Levin, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one-stop for Non-Pop on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR Plainfield, as bent as you'll get.
I guess so. So do you want to, again, recap what we are listening to?
We're listening to Tweak, live at the Weather Vane, somewhere in January 2005. And this is John Levin, myself, Charlie Schneeweiss, and Devin on Circuit Bent Casio MT40.
And you and Charlie were playing what again?
Charlie's playing, I think, a little Roland SH-302, and I'm playing the realistic Concertmate MG-1.
Yes.
Realistic on the outside, Moog on the inside. One of these days, my Odyssey will come back from the repair shop, and then we'll be back in our original formation. That's what I usually play when we do these things.
Describe the Odyssey. Fascinating looking thing.
Yeah, the Odyssey is, it's about 18 inches high or 18 inches deep by about 24 inches wide. And it's got a little short, maybe two and a half octave keyboard on it. But then it's a really classic analog synth. It has two oscillators, one filter, two envelope generators. It has a ring modulator. It has sample and hold and a low frequency oscillator. And that's it, but it's just enough. And it's laid out in this very interesting way so that you don't have to use any patch cords. The most desired connections you want are already sort of pre-routed. And it's whoever laid it out really knew what they were thinking, because especially, I don't know, it just lends itself to making very interesting patches very quickly.
How are the patches made?
With little sliders. The whole panel has got sliders, and so every slider, every control is subject to a slider. So if you have, say, you're modulating oscillator 1 with sample and hold and the ADSR, there's a little slider that allows you to control how much envelope generator or how much sample and hold is whacking the oscillator. And then the two oscillators can control each other, and, you know, it's just, you can, what I like about it is that I can make little self-regulating patches. You can make these patches where everything is modulating something else, and you can just kind of walk away from the whole thing, and it'll play itself for 10 minutes and continue to be interesting.
Should we talk about Sonata Allegro 4 now? There's a little bit of a disconnect there.
Let's disconnect the voices and listen to the last 5 minutes of this set, and then we'll get to something that you've done uniquely yourself.
Good.
We'll be back. Thank you.
In performance, January of this year, 2005, John Levin, Charlie Schneeweiss, and Devin the Circuit Bender.
Yes, about 2.5 minutes from the end, you had your own Götterdämmerung there. The gods were in flames. There were some banshees, and I heard the Valkyries all disappearing in flames. There was some anger there.
There was. That's truly, I think, one of the more industrial works in my repertoire.
Yeah, it doesn't come across sweet and calm the way some of the Ill Winds did.
Yeah, no, that's a definite outtake or something different.
Yeah, you were letting the pus out.
Yeah, that's a real. I heard. Yeah, definitely. I did. I heard that after after I heard that thing. I said that's about the fire.
Yeah.
We were talking over the music off mic and talking about talking over the music
mm-hmm. off mic
and on mic and during the show. What is it about talking over this music?
Well, the context in which it was made, at least the tweak music, is all made in a situation where most of the audience is talking over it, because we are sitting in a bar and we're playing this music and people are talking, and it seems like it's sort of the context in which it's created. And also, I think, it's the kind of thing where we love it if someone wants to pay attention to it in its absolute entirety. But if someone simply wishes to pay attention to it when they choose to and then not pay attention to it when they don't want to, that's okay, too.
Do you ever riff off of the conversations? Can you pick up any of the conversations and then include that into your piece?
No, I don't think so.
You should
distribute microphones on the tables and then start mixing it in.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Or you could have conversationally triggered devices so that every time somebody said...
Oh, CTDs, yes.
Yeah.
We're going to hear a piece that's just yours.
Yeah, this was made...
Title?
It doesn't have... No,
that's
no.
always a problem. You know, we insist on titles from you each time, and every time you come back to the show, you say, oh, it doesn't have a title.
This
you
one,
have not learned.
This one had a title, which was... Hold on.
See.
He's thinking off mic.
He's making it up.
Yeah. Well, his brow is furrowing.
Well, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's something, see, the Latches Marquee, the Wilder Building was next door to the Latches Theater, and when I made this piece, I went downstairs and I looked at the Latches Marquee, and I said, whatever's on the marquee is going to be the title of this piece.
Barbarella.
They were playing a movie about camels in Mongolia, they were playing De Lovely, the Cole Porter movie,
yes.
And they were playing... I can't remember what the third one was. So the title of the piece is, I think, something like Camels in the Doorlight de Lovely.
I like it.
Yeah, that works.
All right. Well, let's start it, and we'll talk over it as required.
Thank you.
So what is it about ABA form that doesn't always make its way into improv?
I don't... That's a good question.
How do you... Take visual cues off of one another, or how do you improvise? What is it that leads you to start at one point and there's some evolution that occurs during the course of the piece, and it's I guess listening to one another, and it's just as you say, you what was the phrase that you taking the focus?
Oh, pulling focus.
Focus. Yes, I don't hear any focus pulling in here.
Well, this is just me.
Yes.
So.
So you can't pull it from yourself.
You can't really pull focus on yourself. When I was working with this piece, working with the Odyssey, there's this weird way in which I feel like the instrument itself is the score. I think I stole that idea from Gordon Mumma, but I'm not sure. But there is a way in which I feel like the instrument is the score. But the thing is that you rearrange the instrument every time you approach it. Every time you approach the instrument, you put the sliders in a different place, and what comes out then leads you to figure out where you're going to go with it next. So that you create an initial sound, and you listen to that sound for a while, and you say, okay, I want to change some parameter of that sound. And so then you change it, and then you wait to see what happens. And then you decide you want to change something else. But on some level, the changes are dictated somewhat by your mind and what you intend to do, but there's another level at which the hardware takes over. And frequently the hardware will make some decision for you.
For our listeners who are not understanding what that means, the particularly analog synthesis is unpredictable in a lot of ways. Because the controls and sliders do not have a replicability. You can't say, we're going to enter the number 21.67, which we used last time, as you might do in a digital unit. You're turning the knob to where you thought it was last time. But because of the sensitivity and interaction of so many possible settings, it is almost impossible to replicate. It is, in fact, impossible to replicate what you had before. And so when you make one change, it may not entirely be the result that you had anticipated. So you can go from there.
And in playing with other people, there is this conversational thing that happens. It's a different time frame. I mean, the Ill Wind Ensemble, the conversational time frame was much faster. You know, someone would play a phrase and someone else would play a phrase. When in Tweak, the conversational time frame is a lot slower because it takes longer to shape a sound. You know, it can take like up to 3 minutes sometimes to shape a particular sound. And so then the other person hears that evolve and then they do something in response to that. And so it's still like playing a game of tennis, but it's a very slow moving
one. You don't have to run for the lobs or for the cross court as quickly.
Right.
What did happen to Ill Wind Ensemble, by the way? Just bring us up to date, or what happened? One left, didn't
Eric moved to Idaho. He picked up everything and moved to Idaho. We carried on for an extended period of time as a trio, and we still... if someone calls us up on the phone and says, we want you guys to show up and play somewhere, we do it. But we're not actively looking for opportunities to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And then also about half of my instrumentarium, of course, was collided.
Yeah. Yes.
where are you headed from here? Not this afternoon,
no,
but
just
artistically. What's the next step? Are you still in an extended recovery period, or have you started totally afresh?
Well, the interesting thing about the fire is that it happened at a point where I was sort of starting afresh, in the sense that the kind of music you're hearing in the background was music that I'd been thinking about making for a long time, but I had sort of stopped doing it for various reasons. And in the summer of 2004, a friend of mine, Stuart Wright, who runs a space in Brattleboro called The Loft, said to me, I want you to get off your butt and finish some pieces and do an all-electronic concert at the Loft. And I said, Stuart, that's ludicrous. I don't want to do this stuff in public. And he said, I don't care what you think, you're going to do this show. And he forced me to make a date. And I think it was September 23rd, I did this show at the Loft where I took the ARP 2600 and I took the Odyssey and I did three things. I performed a piece live in real time on the 2600. I performed a piece live in real time on the Odyssey and the delay. And I also made a tape piece using the Odyssey multi-tracked. And it was the first piece of sort of like, you know, not necessarily thought through because it was a multi-tracked improvisation in response to myself, but it involved pitches and decisions about pitches. And so it was this, it was another 17-minute piece. It was a 17-minute piece. I made it over a period of a couple of months, and I played it once in the Loft for this audience. And then that piece, which was, I think, like, it was the first really good piece that I had finished and completed in a style that was both what I had used to do and a style that was what I'm currently doing and a style that I'm looking forward to the future of doing. And I made it and I presented it, and then it was taken out of my hands.
Gosh. What a concept. I can't imagine. I absolutely can't imagine.
Do you remember the piece Sidewinder by Morton Subotnick?
Uh-huh.
I think we're hearing little snippets of it. Just little nods of the old electronic cap.
Yeah.
The drone filter.
Yes.
The Sidewinder drone filter.
Yeah. But I remembered how I made that piece. And so, I mean, I know what I did, and I know I can do it again. And so I need to get back to that universe again. So that's my plan to move forward, is to go back to working with electronics, with the old analog electronics.
Think you can have it ready by, say, September 17th?
I see what I can do.
Ooh, yes.
Our guest has been John Levin, back in Calvus and Damien for the third time, I believe.
That's correct.
That's called The Charm, isn't
third
it?
Third time's the charm.
The Charm, John Charm Levin. Thanks so much for coming all the way up here to the studios from way down the banana belt of Vermont.
Thank you so much for having me.
A production of Multimedia.